Member of Al-Anon.
Hi.
Hi, y'all. This watch is Beth Singh's, so I don't want to touch it. First of all, I just want to say thank you. Thank you for having us come out here and be a part of such a great weekend. And, you know, Keith said it's fully packed. I don't think so. It's just like I like it. Lots of AA and lots of Al-Anon. And, you know, I spent a lot of my life doing something just opposite from what we do here, and I always feel blessed and very grateful that I get to be a part of something that has changed not only my life, but I get to watch it change other people's lives. And there's no greater blessing for me than that. And I want to thank Keith and Sue somewhere. They called and asked us to come. What an honor and a privilege. I was just out here at Woman's Safe Place year before last, and I just felt like I was coming home. I told Joe, I said, you know, I know where the room is that I stayed in. We're staying in the same room. I feel like, you know, this is like my place now. It doesn't take much. It really doesn't. I came to Al-Anon November the 5th, 1986, a broken person, bankrupt in every single way. Emotionally, physically, financially, I just run out of airspeed and ideas and all at the same time, and it surely wasn't anything that I had decided to do. It was a set of circumstances that were put in motion a long, long time ago. I've loved drunks all my life from the very earliest get-go. I can remember at 5 years old knowing how much I loved my daddy, and I just could not figure out why he changed when he did what my mother said. She said he got drunk. And they didn't say the word drunk, they'd spell it. And in those little five-year-old ears, like I could spell, I wasn't really all that sharp. I heard E-R-K. So they would go around saying, Bill's D-R-U-N-K, and I'd go around saying, is Daddy E-R-K yet? Where is Daddy? Is he E-R-K? And I didn't know what that meant, except that I just loved my daddy, and when he drank, he changed. He was that Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. He'd give you a shirt off of his back when he was sober, but when he was drunk, he turned mean and violent, and I couldn't figure that out. And I just knew that I should be the one that does something to change that. She surely wasn't doing anything to change that. I knew who the problem was. It was her. And if she'd just go away, if she'd just disappear, if she'd just shut up, he would have been okay. She started it every single time. And I can remember from maybe not five, but from the very earliest, I was never going to be like her. Never. Guess what happened? They fought and fussed, and I got in the middle of them just as soon as I could. And I'd make her come in my room and get in bed. She wouldn't stay in there because he was in their bedroom, and she'd have to go in and tell him something else about 50 more times. But usually it'd settle down. And, you know, I did that over and over and over. And I was a really bad student in school. I don't know that I'd have been a good student. But I know I wasn't a good student because I stayed up all night waiting and watching and listening for the fight. And I did that one day at a time, you know, till I just began to live in that, you know, full flight from reality, and in that delusion and in that fantasy that as soon as I got out of here, everything was going to be okay. You know, about 18 years old, I graduated from high school. Here again, I'm not sure. Well, I know how I did it. I lied, cheat, and stole. I learned how to do that really early. You know, I can make a cheat sheet where nobody can find it. And I can copy off your paper if you're sitting 2 aisles away from me. And I usually had people around me that were pretty smart, and they'd enable me to do that. And I'd get caught a lot cheating. And, you know, if a teacher confronted me with it, I'd just confront them back. Prove it. Just prove that I was cheating. You know, I feared nothing. Dumb. That's dumb. But I feared nothing. And that's the way I got out of high school, and I was going off to college in September. And that summer, something really weird happened. This guy that I had grown up with, I mean, we'd play together as two-year-olds. He was certainly not a prospect, not at all. He was a bad boy. He liked fast cars. He took advantage of the girls. I know, because one of my best friends he took advantage of. And he just wasn't in my scope. And he called and said, you want to go to the movie? And I said, oh, sure, just thinking it was just a friend going to the movie. And he picked me up, and we drove into Dallas. I grew up in Carrollton, Texas. And we drove into Dallas, and we went to the Inwood Theater on Lover's Lane. And if you're familiar with Dallas, that's one of the old movies, the Art Deco movies now we call them. It had the upstairs balcony. And I know there are lots of faces in here that know about the balcony. I can see you. There's a lot of faces in here that don't even know what I'm talking about. But the balcony was where all of the couples went. And there was usually a lot of kissing and familiarity. Now, not according to today's standards, you understand, but back then it was pretty racy to go up to the balcony. And he bought me popcorn and he bought me a soft drink and he said, come on, and he started up those stairs. I thought, oh, no way, no way. And I ate that popcorn one kernel at a time. It took me a long time, too, almost all the way through the movie. And I ran out of popcorn, and he reached over and took my hand, and he became a prospect right then. You know, that's just how I am. I'm not interested, but you show me one bit of interest, and I am interested in you. And, you know, I was just gone from there. Our relationship went to fast forward really quick. September was coming. He was going to be in the same college that I was in. He had an apartment, and I was moving into the dorm. And I did move into the dorm, and we got married, and I got pregnant, and not in that order. We got the cart before the horse, and pretty soon he was trying to get me to get out of that dorm, and I was saying no, you know, no. And if he had made me, he came and picked me up one day after class and said, we're going to Dallas and tell your parents that we are married. And I said, and that's all we're telling them. And I didn't want to move out of that dorm. I'd still be in that dorm now. She's about 44 years old, and I'm not going to talk about how old I am, but we'd both still be there. I would have never come up off of that I was pregnant and that we were married for anything, but he insisted. He thought that's what we should do, and that is what we did. And we moved into that apartment. It wasn't very long till he realized that he couldn't afford school, an apartment, and a wife, and a new baby. And he said, we need to move back to Dallas. And we did. We got a townhouse in Dallas, and we moved in. And, you know, I was never, ever going to live the way my mom and dad did. And, you know, I don't know. Just in the blink of an eye, I wanted to know all the things that my mother kept asking my dad. She had three things that she asked him on a regular basis that I thought she was a little brain dead for. She wanted to know where he'd been and who he'd been with and what he'd been doing. And my dad had never been anywhere. He'd never been with anybody. And he'd never done anything. And I just thought, she is so stupid that she asked him that over and over and over. And he says the same thing every time. I knew he'd been somewhere. I knew he'd been with somebody. And I knew that he had done something. So, you know, it was like, and that was what I was doing. I wanted to know where he'd been and what he'd been doing and who he'd been doing it with. And it just, I don't know, it just was like it was just a part of me. And I was pregnant and sick, and it was just a rough get start. And he was a hard worker, and we bought a house about 6 months later before the baby came. And I didn't know how to be married. I didn't know what to do, and neither did he. And we didn't even know any of that. We just were trying to make it up as we went along the way. And I didn't know I was a good cook, but he seemed to look like it. He went from about 130 pounds to like 210 pounds pretty quick. And, you know, in Texas we do a lot of chicken fried steak, mashed potatoes, and gravy. And, you know, I guess that's what I was doing. I don't know. But he gained a lot of weight. And, you know, I know what to do when there's alcohol. My dad drank alcohol. And, you know, he'd say, I can remember hearing him say this as I was growing up. He'd say, if you talked anything about drugs, and there really wasn't a lot of talk about drugs. There was a little talk about dope. And he'd say, well, they're just a dope thing. And he'd say it with such disdain that it just, like, scared me to death. But alcohol seemed to be okay, even though you couldn't buy it in Texas. It was brown bag. But we just didn't see anybody or know anybody that was a dope thing. But I knew what alcohol was. I knew how it smelled. I knew what you did. I knew the whole thing about it. And about year two that we were married, and he'd gained all this weight. There was a doctor in Dallas, and he went to the doctor, and he got these little green spancels, and they were to lose weight. And, you know, I didn't know anything about anything, dumb and happy, and, well, almost happy. And he started taking them, and, you know, things began to get a little different. I didn't know he was taking more than one. I didn't know that he was taking more than two. I didn't know that he was getting them all the time. And pretty soon, I was in the battle with something that I had never experienced before. And it wasn't very long until those little green spancels turned to black ones. And I sure didn't know anything about those. And he began to take those. And when he began to take those, he got crazy. But the thing of it was, I got crazier. I was in competition with something that I didn't even know what it was, and I wanted to know where he'd been and what he'd been doing and who he'd been doing it with. And my mom used to put me in the car with her and take me down on Harry Hines to look for my dad. And, you know, she'd find his car and she'd pull in that, it wasn't really a bar, it was a beer joint, and she'd pull in that beer joint and she'd say, "You go in and get him." And I can remember, I'm not the one looking for him. You're the one looking for him. You're the one that was bawling at home, and now you're calling him every name under the sun, and you send me in to get him. And so, you know, I'd go in to get him, and he'd be so happy to see me. He'd say, "Come on, gal," and he'd put me up on that bar stool, and he'd say, "You want a Coke?" And I'd say, "Yes," and he'd introduce me to all of his buddies. And, you know, I was 25. I just thought I was their age. And here we are. He's out, and I've got these two kids, and we'd go looking for him. Only I wasn't ever going to do what my mother did. I was not sending my kids in a bar after my dad. And I didn't. I left them in the dark parking lot. I went in. I don't know how those bouncers at the door knew I was a wife. I guess by the look on my face. But they did. And he'd be in there, and my babies would be sitting out in the dark parking lot, scared to death. And, you know, I never thought that they'd be scared. I never thought that there was anything wrong with that. I just wasn't going to do what my mama did. And one day at a time, we just fussed and fought and raised Cain. And, you know, I grew up watching my dad club my mom pretty good. She had a yapping mouth, and he'd just get tired of her, and he would pop her one. And, you know, she had busted lips and black eyes, and I just think if you'd just stay shut up and made a decision that nobody was ever going to hit me, and, you know, the fight would start, and instead of me going to the hospital with my mother to see her face get sewn up, he was going to the hospital to get his face sewed up, because I'd pick up whatever, a telephone. You know, in those days we had ashtrays bigger than this book. They were heavy. And just anything. If I'd have had a gun, I would have shot him. I had that much rage and anger going inside of me. And I know that today. Thank God that that wasn't what was going on. But we fought and fussed and went over to Parkland Hospital because we didn't want to go anyplace close to home and watch his face get sewed up. And he'd say, "What are we going to tell everybody?" And I'd say, "Tell them the truth. Tell them you're a son of a bitch." And he didn't think that was very funny. We stayed married for almost 10 years, and out of that came, you know, for him, professionally, great success. He made a lot of money. He was in sales, and he made a lot of money, and that just seemed to be like oil on the fire. It didn't help it any. It bought a lot of things, and it bought a lot of unhappiness, and I had those two kids in the middle of it, and I was just as crazy. If I'd been doing something, if I'd been taking drugs or drinking, I don't think I could have been any crazier. And, I don't know, about year 9, we had an incident that happened. I was over at a girlfriend's house and had my kids with me, and my dad called, and he was out of town working, and my dad called and said, "Can I come pick the kids up and take them home and spend the night?" And I said, "Sure," and he picked them up, and I stayed at my friend's house for a little while, and then I went on home, and it was about 10 o'clock, I guess, and I opened the front door, and you know, just walked on back into the back of the house, and when I walked in our bedroom, I could smell cologne, and all my little senses started up, and I thought, "What is that?" And I walked over to his side of the where the bathroom was, and his cologne was pulled out, and I thought, "This isn't right." Now, if you're an Al-Anon of my type, you know that cologne wasn't that way when you left. You know those towels weren't rumpled on the hanger. You know when you walk in the kitchen and there's a glass and still water in the sink. You know you didn't leave it that way. And I mean, everything inside of me just went on alert. And I started for that front door. And just as I started for the front door, the back door opened. And if you're an Al-Anon of my type, you know when those shoes hit that hardwood floor, you can tell who he belongs to. And I knew it was him. And I said, Jerry. And he said, yes. And he said, where were you going? And I said, I was going to Mother and Daddy's. I said, I thought somebody had come in the house. Now, he'd been out of town. He'd flown in. He'd come to the house. I guess he thought I was seeing somebody. I wasn't. And the fight started. And I had on a pair of slacks and a blouse and undergarments at the time. And pretty soon, I didn't have any of those on. We started, as that fight started, he just started ripping my clothes off of me. And pretty soon, I was standing there just buck naked. And, you know, I was crying and also trying to defend myself at the same time. And he got up and left and went back into the back of the house into our game room. And I was standing at the kitchen counter naked, and I heard those doors to that gun cabinet open. And I heard him take that gun out of the gun cabinet, and I heard him break it. And I hunted with my dad when I was a kid, so I knew the sound of a shotgun breaking. And I heard him drop those two shells down in it, and I heard him click it closed. And when it clicked, it closed. I wasn't a praying girl. I'd left God a long time ago. But I said that prayer of emergency, if you'll get me out of this, I won't come back. And I hit that front door running and ran down the street naked, ran until I found some place that I could hide from him, and because I knew that he was going to shoot me. And I climbed in a lady's flower bed, and I laid there, and I watched him walk up and down those streets with that gun across his arms looking for me. It seemed like forever, guys. I don't know. It may have been 5 seconds, but it seemed like an eternity to me. And he finally went in the house, and I knocked on that lady's door, and she came to the door, and I was naked. And I said, I need help. And she said, come on in, and she gave me something to put on. And I called my aunt and uncle, and they came over and got me. And the next day I went to the attorney's office. And, you know, you'd think that'd be enough, but that's not enough for an Al-Anon of my type, not really. I filed for divorce, and about 2 weeks later we're in the attorney's office. We're in the conference room, and he's with his attorney, and I'm with my attorney. It's all looking very professional and fixing to be divided and all that good stuff. And both attorneys knew what had happened. They knew about the gun. They knew about the fight. They knew about being naked. They knew all of it. And he looked over at him, and he said, I'd like to talk to her by herself. And they both looked at me with eyes so incredulous. And I said, okay. Because if you're an Al-Anon of my type, you can't remember what happened 2 weeks ago. You can't remember the fear. You can't remember being naked. He just said he wanted to talk to me. That's all. And he did what he did over and over, had been doing for a long, long time. He sat down across that table from me, and he said, you know, we've got two beautiful children, and we've got a great life, and we've got every single thing we want and can have everything that we ever wanted. But we just can't do this. And he had a beautiful piece of jewelry, and he slid that across that table to me, and one more time I sold myself for a piece of jewelry and a promise. And we got up and we walked out of that attorney's office, and those two attorneys were sitting there just like, they couldn't believe it, I don't believe. And we walked off, and, you know, I said to myself that day, I said, if, you know, in a year, if this isn't better and different and going in a good direction, I'm gone. I'm not staying another year. And that was year 9. And something happened very quickly, and I really don't remember what that was, but it was just something inside of me that knew that nothing had changed. I don't know if he didn't come home. I don't know if he had lipstick on his clothes. I don't remember what it was, but something inside of me. And it was like somebody threw a light switch. And I was driving my kids to school one morning, and in a car next, letting his kids out, was this good-looking guy. And he pulled up and pulled over beside me, and he said, let's go have a cup of coffee. And we did, and, you know, that started an affair for me, something that I had not been involved in before. And during that year, I just got further and further away. And, you know, I'm one of those Al-Anons that just can't leave unless you have somebody already over here. And he was the somebody that was already over here. I wish I could stand up here and tell you I was a woman of good principles and values and morals. I had none, absolutely none. I was not really interested in him. He was just a way out. And I took the way out. And before that year was up, I had filed for divorce again. And there were other women in my husband's life, and I had known that for a long time. But he didn't like it that there was somebody in my life. And, you know, then the stalking began, and the guns began again, and it was car chases, and, you know, I was in hiding, and all that crazy insanity that goes along with doing what we do. And, you know, just jumping every time a car backfire, or looking around the corner trying to figure out if somebody's going to be there. And that was just going on over and over again. It was just like growing up, only accelerated. And I didn't even see it. I didn't even know it. That end of that year, I filed for divorce again, and we ended up getting a divorce. And I ended up moving to Houston after about 6 or 8 months because I was having death threats from him, and I was really afraid that he was going to either kill me or have me killed. And I moved down there, and the guy that I was seeing's family was from down there, and I had good protection down there. And that made me feel safe enough. And during that year, lots of things happened for my then ex-husband. He got married again very quickly, and I ended up moving back to Dallas. And the guy that I was seeing, I quit seeing, and I was single for about 3 years. And just doing what I wanted to do and how I wanted to do it. You know, I left my kids. If I was seeing somebody, I'd get them in bed at night, and then I'd leave. And am I proud of that? Absolutely not. But it was just my illness, my disease of untreated Al-Anonism, I just wanted a fix somehow. And I did that over and over. And I was single for about 3 years, and I was over in Fort Worth at the Colonial Golf Tournament. And I looked up, and I like bad boys and pretty packages. I don't know if there's anybody in here that understands that, but it'll get me going every time. And I looked over, and there he was. He was tall, and he had all this shock of blonde hair and wide shoulders and narrow hips, and I thought, He had the trashiest looking blonde sitting on his lap you have ever seen at the country club. Now, I knew if we had been in some of those bars we drank in, that'd have been fine. But at the country club, I thought, you should act just a little bit better, don't you? Just a little better. No, not him. And I was sitting at a table with some friends of mine. I was dating one of the professional golf that were playing in the golf tournament. Had no reason to be interested in this guy. And the next thing I know, he's over at our table and he's asking me for my phone number. I said, no. Oh, God, y'all know how good that is. No. I can't give you my phone number because guys like you are too much trouble. And then that little tension starts, that little bit of electricity that we all love. And it was going. And he said, I got up to go to the ladies' room, and he was right behind me, and he said, your friend gave me your phone number. And I said, I want it back. I'm not going out with you. Don't call me. He said, no, I am. I said, well, then all right, big boy. How about tonight? Now, I had a date. You know, one of the things that happens between Joe and I when we do this together is that we have to have this little argument right before we do this. And I'm going to just go ahead and say it now so we can get it all cleared up. I don't like to go first. I like to go second so I can clean up what he doesn't tell right. But if I don't go first, then you don't know if he's telling it. So, you know, we have this. So we just left it to the guys to pick who went first, and I got the deal. So I get to lay down the story. He's going to give you a rebuttal. Anyway, he said, no, I have a date tonight. And he said, I wouldn't break it with her for you, and I wouldn't break a date with you for her. And I thought, my God, he has character. I did not know he was one. But he called me the next morning, and he said, you want to go to the Colonial today? I've got seats. And I said, yes. And I had a date with this guy. I don't even know what happened to him. I don't want to know what happened to him. That wasn't right to begin with. But anyway, we went back to the Colonial the next day, and 6 weeks later, he moved in with his two black garbage bags. I want to make sure we have... I think he stayed probably that night. You know, I had a bad habit of doing that. I was just really not a good girl. And he just moved in. And it took me 6 whole months to convince him to marry me. And that felt like a really long time. He had 3 kids and I had 2, and we got married, and, you know, we were just, stupid? I don't know. Lack of knowledge? I don't know. We just were running on everything but what we should have been, and we took those 5 kids, his 3 and my 2, and we just blended them together like 2 decks of cards. We just thought, you know, you just do them like this, and you pat them, and, yeah, and... Alcoholism was breaking out in every room in our house, and we didn't know it. We were just like, he and I were in a bubble all by ourselves, and we just ran and did exactly what we wanted to all the time. My idea of taking care of my kids was to give them all a $20 bill, and we lived 2 blocks from the shopping center. You know, yes, you can go to the arcade, but go get you something to eat, and the girls could go over to the drugstore and buy some makeup, and y'all be home, and... I thought that's what they were doing. Well, no, they weren't. But we didn't know that. And, you know, we'd stay out till 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning doing what we did, running around with our friends and up to no good, just absolutely up to no good. He and I both were working, and we were gone all day, and the kids had come home from school. And my son told me not too long ago, I said to him, "Your kids walk on your furniture." He said, "I know, Mom." I said, "Well... you won't have furniture very long if you let them walk on your furniture. I'm talking walk on them with their feet." He said, "When y'all were gone, you just couldn't even believe what we did to your furniture." And I went, "La, la, 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 la. I don't want to know that. Don't tell me that." I know that they just ran wild in our house and while we were gone, and didn't stay at home and didn't go eat and didn't do the things that they were up at the Jack in the Box buying dime bags with carpet shavings in it that looked like pot, you know, and stuff like that. And we were in our own world, and so were they. The youngest one was 4. Of course, he was doing nothing except just reacting to all the stuff that was going on. And then we had an 11-year-old, a 12-year-old, a 13-year-old, and a 14-year-old. His, mine, his, mine, his. That's how it worked out. 2 girls were the oldest, and they immediately became good friends. Thank God. You know, God did do some things that really have been great all of these 31 years that Joe and I have been married. And the boys, they all clicked together except the baby, and they were mean as the devil to him. But they still are friends today. They still hold together just like real brothers and sisters. And I wish that Joe and I could take credit for that, but we cannot. I don't know how that happened. It's just a miracle. It really is. They defend each other today. They'll lie for each other today. They just like real brothers and sisters. But we've been married about 10 years, and I called Joe's sister, called Joe's mother. She was in Jackson, Mississippi, and the minute she heard my voice, she started crying, and I said, "What's wrong?" And she said, "Well, I've been over at Jeannie's house for several weeks, and she's getting shock treatment. She's in the psych ward, and I've got her 3 kids, and, you know, I just can't do this anymore." And I said, "Well, just hang on. Just hang on. Let me call Joe, and we'll come up there and see if we can come give you some help." You know, that was my job. I was the helper. If there was any kind of problem at all going on, just give it to me, and I'll get it straight for you. And that's not a good deal. You know, the more you do that, the more you think you can do, the more you think you can do, the more you can do. And it was just like, I thought I ran the universe. You know, if there was ever a problem, everybody came to me. And we got in the car. First of all, I called him and I said, "Come home. We're going to see your mom." And he's, you know, "What's he going to say? Going to go see about your sister?" And he came on home, and I was in my closet, and I looked down, and laying on my floor was a little brass chip. I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous, or I didn't know what it was. But I picked it up and I looked at it, and on one side was the Serenity Prayer, which I did know. It hung in my family's houses, and I loved the prayer, though I didn't have an idea about what it meant. And on the other side was a triangle and a circle, and on the inside of that was a blank spot. I didn't know later that the AA's, that was their chip, and that was where their number was. But I took that chip and I put it in my pocket. And over the next 3 or 4 days, every time I'd get a little tight, and trust me, I was a little tight, I would reach down and feel of that chip. Before we left, though, I did what I always do. You know, I've got to be armed before I go do something. So I called my friend, the psychiatrist, and I found out all the stuff that should be doing to Jeannie and not be doing to Jeannie. And I called my doctor friend to see if there was anything he wanted to add to that. And then I called my lawyer to see what the legal aspects of it were. And I had my yellow tab, you know, I'm a lawyer, almost. Had my legal tablet, and I had all this stuff written down, and I was going to go interview the doctors and find out what the heck was going on. And, you know, the day that we went up there, we went over to the hospital, and I know that that day God went in with me, because when I walked in her room and I looked at her, I did not recognize her. Here was my beautiful sister-in-law, long black eyelashes, just a head full of dark curly hair, the most beautiful smile you've ever seen in your life, and she's yellow. Her hair is laying like rats have been sucking on it. Her eyes are dark. There's no smile. She's twisting the sheet. And I just sat there looking at her with that yellow tablet clutched to my chest. And for the first time in my life, I knew I didn't know. And I didn't even try to make it up. And I got up and walked out of her room, and Joe was coming down the hall, and I said, I'm going to call Glenda. Glenda is Joe's oldest baby sister. And she had 5 years, she and her husband had 5 years in AA at the time, and oh, we were so glad. They were so awful. We didn't care, the cult, we didn't care that they were in that cult. AA, that was good, just so long as they didn't cause the family any more problems. We were very happy about it. Little did we know. I called Glenda and I said, Glenda, we're up here with Jeannie, and I said, I don't know what to do. I called, you know, found out some stuff, but I looked at Jeannie and I said, she's yellow and she's swollen just beyond recognition. And I said, she doesn't even know that I'm in the room. And she was so sedated. And I said, everything about her has changed. And I said, she said, well, I know. And I said, you do? She said, yeah, she's being treated for the wrong thing. Okay. I said, so what? She said, she needs to be in alcohol treatment. And I was like, well, I don't know anything about that. And that was the first honest thing I'd said maybe in a long, long time. I did not know anything about alcoholism or the alcoholic. I'd been doing it my whole life and didn't even have a clue that that's what it was. It was the first time I'd ever had a word associated with it. I said, can you come? And she said, yes. Well, you know, I later found out that that's a 12-step call. I didn't know it at the time. She told me later, I'd been waiting 5 years for one of y'all to call. And she got on the plane, and she flew from Austin, and she got off the plane, and she had a garment bag, and it had 300 pounds of AA books in it and one dress. She and I drugged that garment bag through the airport, and we got it in the car, and we checked in the motel, and, you know, we went over to see Jeannie the next day, and we just took her out of that hospital, and the doctors were all screaming that she was going to die, and we took her over to a treatment center there in Jackson, Mississippi, and the family was there, and we said, you know, if you don't want to do this, that's okay, but we're through. And she was not a happy camper at all, and she did go into treatment, and that was the beginning of my recovery. I didn't know that. I didn't know that Jeannie's recovery was going to be the beginning of ours. We got in the car and started home a couple of days later, and my daughter called and said, boy, she was mad. Oh, how dare we be up there helping Jeannie when we knew she needed help? Why couldn't we do something for her? And, well, we tried to do things for Stace, but, you know, the bottom line, if you don't know what to do, how do you know what to do to help? We didn't know what to do. We didn't know what was wrong. We didn't know that she was crazy, doing all kinds of stuff and just crazy. She had about 4 or 5 years in college, and I think she'd still be in college today if something hadn't happened. And the next day I got on the plane and flew down to Austin and went over to her apartment, and I said, you know, I found out something that I think is wrong with all of us. and if you'll come go with me, maybe you can get some help. And I said, you know, we found a treatment center up north of Dallas, and she didn't want to go there. She wanted to go to Hawaii. You know how you all are. That little treatment center north of Dallas didn't have the sunshine. She wanted a good tan. And oh, I was just like, you better come go with us if you want help. And, you know, she said she wasn't. And I got up to leave, and I said, Stace, you know, I don't know that I'll ever be able to offer this again to you. But I know this. I'm not going to continue doing this. And she got her stuff ready in just a short period of time, and we got on that plane and came back to Dallas, and we drove her to that treatment center that night. And then within about 10 days, two of our sons came to us and said, if you think she's got problems, maybe you ought to listen to us. And, oh, they were stealing, had a little business going. You know, they had to earn money to support things that they were trying to do. And we didn't know that. We didn't know that they were stealing your CBs and breaking in your cars and stealing your radar detectors, and then they sell them and get, you know, just entrepreneurial, you know. And they both went into treatment. So within 10 days of November the 5th, 1986, we had three kids in treatment, and my life just exploded. I couldn't stand the inside of me, and I couldn't stand the outside of me. Everything about me hurt. I didn't know whether I was going to the left or right or up or down. That sister-in-law told me to go to Al-Anon. She and I had been to one Al-Anon meeting, and she said, you go to Al-Anon and you get a sponsor. Thank God I had that sister. Thank God. I started going to meetings. I started to Preston, and, you know, I'd go up there, and I'd look, and I'd try to figure out who was going to be my sponsor. I thought there was going to be a blinking sign up here, and there wasn't, and I got the pamphlets and read about sponsorship, because that's just how I am. I asked a couple of people to sponsor me, and thank God both of them said no, you know, that they didn't have a sponsor, and they'd never worked the steps, and they weren't sponsoring anybody, and, you know, I can't imagine where I would have ended up. But a lady was up there one day, and, you know, we talk about having Eskimos here, and she said, have you ever heard that lady over there? And I said, no. I didn't know who that lady was, and never seen her before, actually. And she said, well, see if you can't find out where she's talking. And I've never seen the lady that said that to me ever again. But she carried the message to me. And I walked over, and I introduced myself, and I said, this lady said that you might be speaking someplace, are you? And she said, yes, I'm doing the steps over at the Omega Group. And I went over to the Omega Group every night in February of 1987 and listened to her do the steps. And I'd been coming to meetings long enough. I was going to one to three meetings a day, 7 days a week, because they said that drunks went to meetings, 90 meetings in 90 days, and if it's good enough for the drunks, it's good enough for me. I'll do that too. And I was. And I knew that you didn't raise your hand when the speaker was speaking and ask questions, and I knew you weren't supposed to get up and walk around and go get coffee and go potty, and I knew some of the etiquette, and I was trying to do it, except my hands were just all over the place. I wanted to ask her questions so badly. Everything inside of me was just screaming to find out more, and it was the program of attraction that goes on here. And the first week, I was going to go talk to her, and an awful thing happened. Oh, those people just gathered up around her and were talking to her and hugging her. I just thought that was the grossest thing I'd ever seen. So I left. I came back the next week. I would be the first one up there. Well, you have to be like lightning to do that. So I left again. And the same thing the third week. I just couldn't ever. And during the third and fourth week, I called everybody I knew in Al-Anon. I was so excited. I was using the telephone, all three people. And I called and asked them if they knew this person, which I only knew her first name. And they said no, that they didn't. And so I had to go the fourth week that she was doing these steps. And I knew I had to do something. So I just stole her purse and her book. I walked in, and I just, you know, her books were there and her purse was sitting on top, and I just picked them up like this and walked to the very back of the room and sat down. And she was standing at the front of the room. When I turned around, I could see her going. She was watching me. I got her attention. She she talked, and she just did a great job that night. And after the meeting was over, she came back over there where I had her books, and she said, "Can I help you?" And I said, "Yeah, I hope so." I said, "I'd like to talk to you." And she sat down, and we talked for a few minutes. And the next day, she was going to Fort Worth, and I asked her if I could take her, and she said yes. And I was very excited about that, although I ran a red light, ran a stop sign, and almost got us killed. And coming back from Fort Worth, she says that I asked her to sponsor me. I'm not going to quibble about that. I don't think I had the courage to ask her anything, but she ended up being my sponsor, and she was my sponsor for the next 13 years. And she literally hand-spoon-fed me Al-Anon, and the kind of Al-Anon that you all do here, where it's first. It's not before, it's before your family, it's before everything. And it certainly came before my family. My family was locked up, and Joe was at home doing what Joe did. And, you know, I just knew that for the first time in my life, I was going to have to save my own life. I couldn't save another person's life. I'd been doing that since I was a very young girl, and I was just to the end of my road. And I did what she asked me to do. She said, "I want you to go to conferences, women's conferences, conferences. I want you to go to meetings." Now, we had a little problem with how many. She said, "I want you to go to 2 Al-Anon and 1 Open AA speaker every week." I said, "Are you sure that's enough?" She assured me that if I would do that from now on, it would be enough. And it has been enough. I've gone to a lot more than that throughout the years. But it has been enough to hold me in the middle of an Al-Anon program, and I am grateful for that. She was a big book Al-Anon, and that's very important to me because I don't believe that Al-Anon has steps. I believe we work the AA steps out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she took me through that book. And she told me that I was going to read that book for the rest of my life, the first 164 pages, over and over and over until it became a part of the inside of me. And I've done that. I read my literature. I go to meetings. I still participate. I still take part. I still hold my hand up and do jobs. I sweep. I do anything that's necessary in my home group. I did a lot of things with that sponsor, and I'm very, very, very grateful for that. And a time came where my sponsor just went in a direction that I couldn't go anymore, and we parted ways. And That was not an easy thing to do. There was a woman in my group that I had great respect for. Her name was Gracie Aronofsky, and I can use her last name because she and David both are in the big meeting now. Gracie sat in my meetings, my very first meeting, and I knew her, and she was coming to my home group. She'd been a member of Preston for many, many, many years, ever since Preston started, I believe. And she ended up coming over to the Big Book group, and she would say to me, "This is old Al-Anon. This is old Al-Anon. Y'all do old Al-Anon. None of that new stuff." And she came, and a couple of her friends came, and Grace just seemed to be the likely choice for me. David had gone to the big meeting already, and I'd spent every day with Gracie for the first 2 years after he passed away. I just tried to be of service to her. And service to her as a friend and as a fellow Al-Anon and as a woman friend. And we did a lot of things together, and we grew very close. So she was the likely choice for me. And Grace started sponsoring me, and it was a great trip. And I just absolutely wouldn't trade for it. And she moved to Denver, and I ended going up to Denver to see her. And it was all too short. Grace had some illnesses, and she passed away several years ago, and I miss her. I miss her very much. Grace was gone, and, I need a new sponsor. I'm just one of those people that just can't have nobody. And so I just thought, I don't want to pick. I just prayed. I said, "God, you just put the person in front of me." And, I'd think it would be this person, and then it would just be like smoke and mirrors. I don't know if you can understand. It would just be like it wouldn't be the one. And, I came out here year before last to a woman's safe place and just had a great time. And, Sue was the very first speaker I ever heard. And I got her phone number that time that she spoke in Texas down at Austin. But I didn't have the courage to call her, and I didn't know how to say the word, "Sue, would you sponsor me?" I just was too green and too afraid, and I just didn't know how. I didn't know what to do. And I came out here, and we've seen each other through the years often, off and on, and I knew how much Grace respected Sue. And we clicked when I came here, but I didn't ask her. It just It didn't cross my mind, really. But we went home, and I called her a couple of times, and she'd call me a couple of times. And what went through my head one day when she called is, why isn't this woman your sponsor? Why isn't she your sponsor? And I said, will you sponsor me? And she, of course, said yes, and thank you. Thank you. I don't want to be a loose cannon in Al-Anon. I don't want to be out here running all by myself. I need someone that I respect, that I know knows me and knows all about me. And, you know, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love what Alcoholics Anonymous does. I love what Alcoholics Anonymous has given Al-Anon. You've given us our steps. You've given us our traditions. You've given us your friendship and your fellowship. And I love that. We've got kids that have done all kinds of things. Now, 4 out of our 5 kids are admitted alcoholic. I wish I could stand up here and tell you that they're all clean and sober today. They're not. We have one that has 60 days, and it's his first round with AA. And he is so excited about Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's just a true gift and a pleasure to get to watch. He said if he had known, he would have come here a long time ago. He didn't know it was going to be this much fun. We've got a son that's in the Air Force, and the United States Air Force keeps him out of the ditches. He loves his job. He has a high security clearance, and he can't do it and do what he wants to do. And he's fixing to muster out, so it's going to be an interesting ride to see where that's all going to go. We have another son who was in treatment, the ones that all came out at the same time. He's not stayed in AA. He just runs a really tight control over his life, and he works tons of hours, and, you know, we just don't mess around with him in his life. He's just got to do it the way he needs to do it. We've got a daughter that has been in and out of AA, and she's been on the streets. I think when I was out of the Woman's Safe Place, she was out in the street. She's been back in AA. She's back out of AA. You know, she's just got to do it until she doesn't have to do it anymore. And we can love her today enough to let her go and to let her find her way. She calls with these desperate things, and we have to use the skills that you all have given us. You know, I'm sorry. And no, we can't do that. She takes lots of runs at us because she knows, for one, that I have a really soft heart. But you all have taught me to have that soft heart without it running my life, and I'm grateful. This last time with her, something happened inside of me, and I told Joe, I said, I don't know what's happened. It's not a feeling that I'm familiar with. It's a feeling inside of me where my daughter's concerned that I've never felt before, that I'm just okay, and it's really more than that. It's that I know that she has to find her way and that I'm not part of it. And I'm okay with that. That's not a feeling that has been with me all the time, and I am grateful for that. Joe and I have been married 31 years, and I wish I could tell you that every single day has been just on the sunny side of the street. We've had our ups and downs, but I tell you what Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon has taught us, that we can disagree, and we can disagree pretty vigorously, but at the end of the day, we know where we're going to be. And what we're going to be doing, and what we're going to be doing tomorrow. We're going to get up, and we're going to start over on a new day. And we have a great marriage. We have lots of fun. Sometimes we laugh so hard we cry. Sometimes we cry so hard we laugh. We have a good time. And he sponsors lots of people, and so do I. And that kind of keeps us out of the ditch. And I'm grateful for that, very grateful for that. I don't believe that I would ever have a marriage where I would just never say anything. I'm way too mouthy and wordy for that, and he is a gentleman enough that he lets me talk, but he also is a strong member of Alcoholics Anonymous and a strong man, and I'm grateful for that. And thank you so much for having me, and I love you.